Hi, welcome to Head Start, the podcast for race directors and the business of putting on races. From the minute the first participant shows up on race day till the time the last one leaves, responsibility for the well-being of everyone on and around your race course rests with you, the race director. So, how can you make sure your medical preparations are up to scratch? How do you figure out how many and what type of resources to dedicate to your race? And where does your duty of care as the race organizer towards your participants even begin and end, practically, legally, and morally? Well, that is what we'll be discussing today with my guest, Natasha Beach. Besides being the medical director for such prestigious events and organizations as the Manchester Marathon, London Triathlon, and Cancer Research UK, Natasha runs her own multi-award-winning event medical cover company, Sports Medics, as well as heading some of the most high-profile efforts to formalize race medical planning in the UK through her positions as Chief Medical Officer of England Athletics and Medical Advisor to UK Athletics. So, it's a joy and a privilege to have Natasha join us today as we look at the principles and practices behind sound medical planning for races of all types and sizes. Now, one quick note for our astute UK listeners, you may pick up from our discussion of tomato shortages on the fact that this episode was actually recorded a little while back, as most episodes on the podcast are. So I hope and wish you won't hold my tired cliches about turnip salads against me. Lastly, before we get into this amazing episode, I'd like to give a quick shout out to our amazing podcast sponsor, Run Sign Up, Race Director's favorite all-in-one technology solution for endurance and fundraising events. More than 28,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events use Run Sign Up's free and integrated solution to save time, grow their events, and raise more. And we'll be hearing a bit more from this great company a little later in the podcast. But now, let's dive into our discussion on race medical planning with Natasha Beach. Natasha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. I know you're a very, very busy person. Are you traveling today? Are you at home?
No, currently at home. I'm in clinic this afternoon, but I've got a bit of a relaxed morning and time to speak to you guys this morning.
Awesome. And what's home for you?
So I'm based in London, so just south of the river, when I'm actually at home. As you'll hear probably a little bit later on, I travel quite a lot. But yeah, been in London good 20-odd years now.
How are things in London?
Bleak. It's probably, it's not warm, it's not sunny, and we've got a national shortage of tomatoes. Yeah, it's going well in London.
Is it just the tomatoes? I've been following the whole vegetable situation in London. I hear all kind of like salad vegetables have been hit pretty hard.
Yeah, apparently it's a Europe-wide issue, but certainly social media leads us to believe it's not. It seems to be very much a UK issue at the moment.
Yeah, I looked into it a little bit. What I came up with is that supermarkets are not willing to pay the price, I think is the bottom line of it.
Yeah, and I think the problem is in the UK, people will just go, oh, fine, I won't buy salad. So, I mean, during lockdown, the first lot, we had real problems with loo roll. Now we seem to have moved on to tomatoes as an issue. Yeah, the UK's stupid at times, but, you know, we just roll with it.
Plenty of root vegetables, though, if you want to fire up a stew or something.
Yep. Apparently, we've been told to eat turnips. Apparently, we have lots of turnips. I don't think anyone actually eats turnips, though, so that's probably why there's plenty of them around.
Yeah, I mean, people used to, but when you have, you know, when you're used to tomatoes and peppers and stuff, turnip salad sounds a little bit rough.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. There's so many things you do. Your day must have like extra hours or something to mine, because you seem to be like the medical director in like a dozen events and organizations, and you're running your own event medical company on top of everything else. So tell us about everything that you do in the industry.
Kind of in brief, my training is I'm a sports and exercise medicine consultant. So what that means is I'm a doctor that's then trained in sports medicine within the NHS. And from that point, we all tend to have kind of what we call a portfolio career, which means that we don't just work in one discipline. Granted, there are some doctors that will work in just football, for example, because that takes up their life. Whereas most of us will work in different sports, different environments. And so for me, that means that I work in clinic, meaning I see normal people, not necessarily sporty, just with people with back pain, hip pain, knee pain, Like I say, they don't have to be sporty, or they can be. I'll see up to kind of elite athlete level. On top of that, I work for the Lawn Tennis Association. So 2 days a week, I'm there and I look after the performance players. So all the names that you see playing at Wimbledon, US Open, Indian Wells that's coming up, I look after them. And then on top of that, I run a sports medicine company that does medical cover for relatively big events, either mass participation, kind of marathons, half marathons, triathlons, or more elite specific, so international tournaments like the World Indoor Athletics or the World Gymnastics. And so, yeah, I kind of work for lots of different organizations in different environments, and it's fun. It is busy. It's long days, but I enjoy it.
And the NHS you mentioned there at the top of your answer is, of course, the much revered National Health Service that we all love in the UK. This is for our US listeners. We have plenty of those. So I just want to clarify. In terms of the races that you sort of oversee, can you give us a couple of names? I saw quite a lot of like heavy hitters on your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, there's a fair mix. And obviously over the years, it changes. I suppose the big one that people will have heard of is Manchester Marathon, which is a kind of the second biggest marathon behind London. Then we'll also work on things like London Winter Run, which will be a 10K. Triathlon wise, we'll like do Blenheim or London Triathlon or the World Championships, which are normally in Leeds, but moving to Sunderland for this year. And then kind of historically, we've done slightly tenuous link to running. We worked for Tough Mudder for 5 years, so planning the medical cover for obstacle course racing. Which was, essentially a 12-mile run plus challenges. It's probably the easiest way to describe it along the way.
Yeah. And Tough Mudder actually was your gateway to this whole thing, right? It's how you got involved with races as a medical director and went on to do the kind of things you do.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of fell into this. I often get asked how I ended up doing this job. And I'm still not entirely sure how it happened. I just remember being away with England Hockey in Belgium and getting a phone call from the event director of Tough Mudder and saying, oh, we'd like you to be our medical director. I mean, I'd never heard of the event. I didn't have a team. I didn't have any equipment. And for some bizarre reason, I said yes, obviously with some background research into what I was then getting into. And I suppose, I mean, it doesn't matter where in the world you are. The event industry is relatively small. And what tends to happen is you work for event, the event director leaves or someone else from the team leaves and goes to a different company. Then they phone you and ask you, can you come in and do that? And it just kind of snowballed from that. And I loved working for Tough Mudder. It was hard work, medically very, very busy. Very interesting, though. You had to really think about the challenges of each different race, different environments, different, you know, how hilly it was, what the access was like, you know, where they're allowed to dig obstacles, where they have to put high obstacles. And that's all, you know, restricted in essence by the landowners. So it kind of really made me think. It's not just a case of, you know, putting in a replica medical cover in every event you do. You really have to appreciate the environment that you're working in. And it taught me loads, so much. And I apply those principles to all the events I work at now. Be it, you know, Tough Mudder, I used to do site visits and turn up with a spade so that I could dig up the ground and see if there was flint or stone in certain areas. You know, obviously I don't have to do that if it's a road race in central London, but you still got to, you know, think, where can you stick medical posts? What does it look like? Can you access it? Where are people likely to collapse? I learned an awful lot, and it was a baptism of fire, but it was a real learning experience.
And they're not making your life any easier, those obstacle races. I think, isn't it like that they use like electrified nets or something in some?
Yeah.
Like very, very low voltage, I hope, but still electrified.
Yeah, we used to electrocute people. In fact, they still do. Yeah, again, it's, you know, working out which participants you can allow through those obstacles, which you can't. So if you know, for example, that they've got the ability to have seizures, if there's someone who's epileptic or has non-epileptic seizures, you know, lots of strong messaging, do not go through this obstacle. Actually, the, you know, like you say, it is low voltage, it stings, it burns, but it's not, you know, it's not horrible. But the aim of those obstacles is to challenge you. So what is your fear? Is it height? Is it water? Is it being in a confined space? Is it being electrocuted?
Is it all of the above?
Is it all of the above? I think if it is, you probably shouldn't be there. You'd never get very far. It challenges people, and people loved it. And it was a great set of events to work on.
Yeah, it's a nice event. I did one in Battersea, actually.
Oh, was that one of the 5K ones?
Yeah, it was like ages ago, but it was like a great experience actually. It was really nice. You know, like combining, as you say, like the whole endurance thing with the obstacles and everything is great. And you're yourself a quite sporty person, right? You were telling me offline you're going off on a tennis holiday and stuff.
It's not my not so secret passion that I am absolutely tennis obsessed. So working for the Lawn Tennis Association is kind of a dream job. But yeah, I love sport. I love everything about it. It's the area of medicine I've chosen to work in. Like, we get asked as a company to do festivals and concerts for medical covering, and we turn it down. It's not our bag. It's not what we're trained in. You know, we pride ourselves in our knowledge of sports medicine, which is slightly different to event medicine. Event medicine is just kind of generic medical cover, whereas we want to take that step further and give our patients, you know, that little bit of higher level care. And also, you know, all the anti-doping rules that you need to know about when it's an elite event, like we as medics need to know about that. But yeah, I do probably then take it slightly beyond and then go off and play a lot of tennis when I can. I don't really know how I fit it in, and there are definitely months where I don't fit it in when the event season is manic. But this time of year, I've just got a little bit of breathing space before it really starts to kick in.
That's awesome. Enjoy it. Well, let's have a look actually at that, since you mentioned the whole, I guess, distinction between generic event medicine, which is, you know, like showing up at a concert or something, and the kinds of things that we're looking at. And let's put aside the elite side of things for a sec, which has its own complications. Looking at mass participation, the kinds of things that, you know, the people listening in, the kinds of events that it's their kind of bread and butter to put on, you know, the marathons, the 10Ks, the triathlons. Before we get into the planning and like preparing and getting ready for all that stuff as a race director, I was actually quite curious to get your take a little bit on the physiology of the average runner or cyclist or whatever going through this kind of thing, right? Because I think it might be surprising how much stress even a casual 5-10K can put on a person, right? Particularly when they're out there running for time or whatever. Can you sort of like briefly give us a little bit of a glimpse into all that, what's happening in the human body when someone is out there doing that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is there's no average participant. Everyone is doing these events for a different reason, be it they might be entering a 5K now, but it's part of a stepping stone for them ultimately trying to do a marathon in a year's time or so. It's progression. Then you've got people that just want to do a 5K and they're doing it for the social element of fitness, and they're not there for time. They're just there to enjoy the environment. And then you've obviously got your charity runners as well, who are doing it for something that means something to them. And, you know, they're sometimes the hardest ones for us to work with, because they're the ones that, you know, have got all that pressure of all the money that they've raised. And, you know, we're saying you need to stop. Like, you can't run. Like, we think you've got a stress fracture, for example. And they're like, you know, it means so much to them. And then you've got the ones who really are going for time, the ones who are stood at that start line. They're the ones who are absolutely at the front with their watches ready, and they will push and push and push themselves. And medically, they are probably the ones that we see the sickest element of. So, you know, most people, you know, we're saying musculoskeletal injuries, sore knees, sore backs, they've fallen over, they've tripped over something. It's the fast ones that are the ones that probably have the most extreme changes to their bodies when they're running. And I suppose the thing that we all worry about is when they get too hot. So when you exercise, your muscles generate heat. And it's definitely more of a male thing than a female thing. And we think that's twofold. One, men generally have more muscle bulk, so therefore they generate more heat. But also women tend to be a bit more sensible.
I can see that.
And if they don't feel well, they tend to slow down a little bit. But, you know, it does happen to women, but certainly in the medical tent. I mean, if I was to analyze the data of those who come in collapsed because of being too hot, oh, it's probably 90% male. It's a very male thing. And they can be incredibly sick. They can be everything from just not feeling quite right, that's fine, to having rectal temperatures of 42 degrees, unconscious, fitting. They're not treated quickly, you know, they can die from this. And that's something that you have to be absolutely prepared for. And I've seen it even in a 10K with an air temperature of 4 degrees, we still have people coming in hot. And it's that going for time element. And then there's the ones that kind of, the things that kind of surprise everyone, well, not surprise because we anticipate it, but the cardiac issues, the heart attacks that happen at the events. And, you know, people say, well, why do they happen at the event and not when they're training? And I think when you're training, you know, there's less pressure. It's not the day. You haven't got the anticipation, the nervousness of the day. And it's just that extra stress. And, you know, we see it in the elite world. Like, for example, Fabrice Muamba, the footballer that had a cardiac arrest. Oh, God, it was probably around 10 years ago now while playing a football match. And he, as an elite athlete, has cardiac screening every single year as a minimum, stressed out on a treadmill. Everyone's looking at their heart tracing. Yet he still went on to have a funny heart rhythm that led to a cardiac arrest on the pitch. And that's because you can't ever replicate the environment of the match, the race, in a testing environment. You just can't do it. You can get close, but it will never replicate that. And so, again, you have to be prepared. And we've had participants who've had cardiac arrests at 3 kilometres into a race. That happened 10K last year for us. So you just have to always expect it. And I often say to people, you know, it doesn't matter how many runners there are, whether you've got one runner or you've got 20,000 runners, the risk is still there and you have to be prepared for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we can all sympathize with that, even as race participants ourselves, the distinction between a casual training run and race day. How many times have we not all gone much faster than our pace on just the adrenaline of it, right? You just shoot out the gate. You don't know what you're doing, right? You need to hold yourself back. Otherwise, you know you're going to run into trouble. And this is just even being reasonable. And of course, speed that you mentioned there, particularly on muscular and skeletal things and stuff like that. Speed, it's a very nonlinear thing, right? I mean, you know, you go 20% faster, you're not putting just 20% more strain on the body. You're putting a lot more strain on the body. When you start going fast, I mean, you need to earn going fast. You can't just start going out there, right?
No, and that's why people should train for events. We know they don't always. And that's, some of that's unintentional, like they've been injured. And, you know, again, it's that charity effect, like they won a race for the charity. And we see that a lot in the run-up to Manchester Marathon, to London Marathon, with people kind of coming into clinic going, I need to run. And I'm like, you can't. Like, no, I'm going to do it. And then you get the people who just decide that they're actually superhuman and they're just going to wing it. But that is why, in theory, you should follow a proper training program that's graded, that's got sprint work, it's got distance, that's gradually building up a period of times. I mean, when I ran London Marathon way back in 2010, you know, I remember my training program was at least 3 months long, and that was on a background of doing a fair amount of running. But you just have to build it up slowly, and you've got to take these seriously. And, you know, it might just be a 5K, but it depends what your baseline is. If your baseline is, you know, you can walk to the shops, well, actually a 5K can feel like a marathon to some people. So, you know, you're right. It's speed, and it's not just about kind of going too quick at the start of the race, because often, certainly like when I did London, I remember being really frustrated at the beginning that you couldn't run because you're just surrounded by people and it's just very congested. And I was, you know, one of those people going for a vague time. And so you're constantly looking at your watch thinking, well, I've got to make this time up. So, you know, you then go too quick when you can start running, and then you crash and burn towards the end, which I absolutely did.
Yeah, well, we've all been there. It's you cannot not be a marathon runner and have crashed through some kind of wall or many walls all in the same race.
Yep.
It's one of those fascinating things about human nature that you can actually bring yourself to the point of actually doing serious damage to yourself and still not stopping, right? When it comes to like heat exhaustion or even serious injury, like people running on like, you know, broken toes or whatever, right, that I see in some races. It's fascinating, right, that your body just doesn't, I don't know, turn off a switch or something and help you just be more sensible.
Yeah, I think, well, certainly with the hot people, they, if they're conscious when they come to us, they're very clearly confused. So you know, the classic is like, I'll see a triathlete who's come in and they're hot, and you know, you'll be like, oh, do you know where you are at the moment? They're like, oh, I'm at home. And I'm like, not really, you're in a marquee. And then it's like, oh, you've been doing a triathlon. They're like, oh, I can't swim. And I'm like, well, you've just finished the triathlon. Like, they're absolutely delirious. They have no idea who they are, where they are, and they don't regain this bit of their memory. It doesn't come back to them, which, you know, I think is probably not a bad thing. So my theory with a lot of it is we're a bit like herd animals in terms of mentality. Like, you're running and you start to feel ill. And if, you know, like I said, the women, reality is they do tend to slow down because, like, oh, I don't feel very well. Whereas the guys tend to push on a little bit. And they push into that realm where they then become confused. And they don't know they're confused. And they just follow everybody else. Everyone else is running in a certain direction, so they're going to join in. And it's really the reason we see more collapses at the finish than anywhere else, to me, is because that's when you suddenly stop. And so people around you have stopped. And then you're a bit like, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do because I'm confused and I don't know who I am or where I am. And also, obviously, once you stop, your blood circulation drops down because your calf muscles aren't pumping that blood back up to your heart and to your head. And so they tend to drop at that point. That's not to say we don't get hot people collapsing earlier on in the route. We absolutely do. But it's, you know, it's the finish line that's always the busiest location on the medical, from a medical perspective.
Yeah, I read actually about what you just mentioned, this thing about, which I've felt in training as well, which is that when you actually stop exercising, I mean, come to a dead stop, which is what a lot of people do at the finish line, all of these big muscles stop pumping blood around and your pressure drops and all kinds of funny stuff should happen. So it's not, yeah, it's actually not very advisable doing that towards the finish line.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we've all been in a race where you're running and you, in your head, you can see the finish line and that's what you're aiming for. But you've still got to get home afterwards. Like, you've still got to use it. Like, it doesn't end. It's not like you get put in a wheelchair and you don't have to walk for the rest of the day. Like, you've still got to be able to move. And people often say to us, oh, you know, how am I getting home? I'm like, well, you know, you've got to get yourself home. Like, you're medically well enough to leave. And like, oh, but my legs are tired. I'm like, well, you've done a marathon. Like, it's totally to be expected. But on the blood pressure thing, that's often why you'll see the medical team at the finish line. If people are conscious and not talking absolute gibberish at us, we'll lie them down and stick their legs in the air because that gets the blood back towards their head. Often they're cramping at that point as well, so we'll be stretching them out a little bit. But to be honest, they need to finish the marathon or whatever distance and keep moving. And it sounds really cruel, but you know, you've got to keep moving, can slowly get the body cooler, get those muscles still moving, but you know, at a walking pace. And you've just got to be moving, like getting people through that finish line. Because obviously, if they all stop at the finish line, then no one else can get through either. So it's two factors. It's medically, we need to get people moving, but also from a flow perspective, you need to keep people going.
Yeah. Well, finish line medical tents are always a very bizarre sight. I used to, I organized a 100-mile mountain marathon back in 2016. And I think literally there wasn't a single participant who wasn't in the medical tent at the end of it. It was like a war zone. I thought, like, what is this thing? It's like, you know, it's like being in Vietnam or something. Like, everyone was on a stretcher, you know, with some kind of issue. But that happens to you after 100 miles, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and that's to be expected. And that's in the planning. You need to know how many participants. And like, I work out a rough percentage of how many people I think are going to be in my medical tent at any one time. And you scale your medical tent up and down based on that knowledge. So for example, Manchester Marathon that's coming up for us in April, we've got more runners than we've ever had. I'm using data from the previous 2 years of us managing the marathon to kind of judge how big the medical tent is. I mean, it's now vast. Mm-hmm. It's now got 32 majors bays, which is bigger than any London or any hospital in the UK for A&E. We're bigger. But that's because we know what we're expecting and it's a fast race, it's flat. But you have to take into account, you know, where your race is, what the weather is, whether, like, it, for us, if it was in August, for example, well, you know, that tent, we'd easily double it. You've got to judge it. And it's hard because I've been in scenarios where I've had, you know, two events on the same day that have been almost identical, one in London, one up in, say, Manchester. Same number of runners, same distance, same terrain. And one can be crazy busy and the other can be fine. And I've learned over the years that London, yes, you know, it is known to be warmer than other areas of the UK, just because of the buildings, but actually it's the buildings that cause us the problem. Like if they run through the city, the heat that reflects off the buildings, there's just no airflow. And we're not hot like we are in the States. Like, I'm just talking like 14, 15 degrees, but that's enough to medically completely change the event. So previous data is always really important. If we ever get asked to do a new event, first question I ask is, can I see your data from the previous years? Because I need that to get a feel of where this event is going medically so that we can actually plan it appropriately.
So Heat, it's interesting that you mentioned these completely identical races where the only kind of obvious difference between them might be ambient temperature. When you have a hotter race, does that only come out in, you know, a higher incidence of like heat strokes and stuff like that? Or does it sort of like have knock on other kinds of injuries and conditions?
Without looking at the data in great detail, I'd say it's pretty much a heat issue. I don't know because I don't track it. I don't know how many people don't complete the event. So obviously the race organizers do. They know from chip timings who's bailing and who's continuing. I'd imagine the hotter, the more DNFs you get. Equally, I suppose you get more people bailing before it's even started because they look at the forecast and go, nope, not for me. I can't deal with that. But certainly medically, it's more and more hot people. And they're a funny one to treat because they come in looking truly awful. Like the first one I ever saw, I thought, wow, you're going to die. You look absolutely diabolical. 15 minutes later, they're sat up talking to you. And it's really simple medicine. It's cooling them really quickly and being prepared to cool them. And I'm not just talking a flannel or a cold ice pack. I'm talking ice water with towels drenched in this water, constantly cycling from head, chest, legs. And you see them evaporating in front of you. That's how hot these people are. But actually, you know, it's really basic medicine. They don't need blood tests. They don't need lots and lots of monitoring. Like most of them turn around so, so quickly. The problem is they all tend to appear at the same time. And so it feels like the Somme. It's relentless. And everyone's looking around going, God, this is horrific. And the medical team are broken really early on. But then you start to transition in a normal race. So, you know, say it's been a mass start. You then start to lose the hot ones. And then you gain the slower ones who are more kind of aches, pains, falls, that kind of thing. And yeah, you still get the old hot person and the person with chest pain or a stroke or whatever. But the hot ones all seem to appear at once. And that puts a lot of capacity pressure on the medical tent. Like you've got to treat them and get them out as fast as you possibly can. And so, you know, we talked about data and looking at previous data, and you might look at a race and go, oh, they only treated 50 people. But what you also need to ascertain is at what point did those 50 people come in? Did they all come in together? Or was that 50 people that were really evenly spread over 5 hours? Because that's a very different world to deal with. If they're all coming in at once, then you need a massive tent. If it's 50 people that, you know, relatively minor stuff and they come in over the space of 6 hours, then you can absolutely condense your medical team down. You still need to be prepared for the sick one that walks in, but knowing your data on an hourly basis in relation to the start time is also really helpful.
That's a very interesting point. What might be the causes of having those spikes in injury volume? So, you know, like you get like a mass load of people coming through with a similar injury. Like what might be causing that?
So with illness and the heat, it's the faster runners, simply. It's the ones at the front. So we're expecting them. We know them. And this also happens to elite runners as well. Like, you know, anyone who watched the Commonwealth Games 2018, there was a Scottish athlete who was in the men's race. The marathon was in the lead. And I was there working for Team England. So he wasn't my responsibility, but we could all see that he was really unwell on the TV. Like he was at the front on his own and he kept dropping to the floor. And we were literally screaming at the officials to let me go out and try and deal with him because there was no one there. So it does happen at elite level, but you know, there are fewer elite runners, so it feels it's less of an impact. It's the mass participation group. In terms of the same injuries coming in, in theory, it should be just a standard normal distribution of what you'd expect of runners. Obviously, if there's a problem with the route, then, you know, we start to see things. So for example, if I ask my team at the beginning of the day to track trends. So if they, and this is something we started at Tough Mudder, it was like, you know, if you've seen one person that's fallen over, please document where, like what mileage, what did they fall over? Why did it happen? You know, did they just trip over their feet, or is there like a pothole that, you know, they're tripping over? And then if someone else radios through and goes, well, actually, I've just treated someone who's, by the way, someone's just tripped over a pothole. I'm like, oh, hang on, that's the same pothole. It means during the event that real-time information can go back to the event team, who can then go and deal with it and either, you know, cone it off, or, you know, unlikely to fill a pothole in the middle of the event, but, you know, at least make it safe. So real-time data is really important. And one of the things we've started doing is having a live link between the medical, all the medical personnel on site and event control. So they still fill in a normal medical form when they treat a patient. Medically, legally, we have to, you know, name, date of birth, address, all the things that the runner takes. They just literally just want some paracetamol to run off. And you're like, no, I need this detail. But I also get the team to fill in a Google form link that goes to event control with really headline data, like 20-year-old fell in a pothole mile four. You know, that's all I need to know. And that comes through to me in event control. And I can look at it and just and start to put those pieces together and see, is it a cycle responder might have seen the first person? Then a motorbike doctor might have seen someone else. Someone at mile 20 might have then seen someone who also had still fallen at mile four. But those people aren't together, so they're not going to know that there's a trend. But if I can get that data centrally in event control, I can look at it and go, hang on, we've got a problem here. And you deal with it, you real-time managing it, rather than at the end of the event going, oh, by the way, guys, we've seen this. And yeah, there will be things that crop up post-event that we hadn't put the pieces together. But if we are seeing the same injury coming in, it always raises a question, go, why? What's going on here?
Hot weather, you mentioned, I think it's a fairly obvious one for people listening in, that it aggravates the risk, it elevates the risk in these kinds of conditions. I'm guessing cold weather is not as much of a challenge, or other types of extreme weather aside, like, you know, like being hit by a tornado or something. Like, are there any kind of other types of conditions that pose particular challenges from a medical point of view?
I mean, for me, if I'm looking at the weather forecast pre-event, I am looking for 10 degrees and dry. Like, that's dreamy. That's what I really want. Obviously, we still, on that, we need to heat the medical tent, because you've got people who will come in cold, and you've also got, you know, the medical team get cold as well, particularly if you're standing around. So that's kind of like the nice, obviously, heat we've talked about. Once we start to get colder, it depends on the environment. So for example, at Tough Mudder, we're in fairly remote locations. You know, people have come by their car, but there's not really kind of like warm buildings they can go to shelter. So, and it's 12 miles, they're muddy, they're wet. And, you know, the colder the event, we got busier. Also, people tend to move less well and were slipping and sliding on mud. So you get more like fractures, things like that. So that would change that. Whereas if it's a road race, say London Winter Run in February, central London, it's a 10K. We've had a real field temperature of minus four and medically been fine. And that's because, you know, people, they run, they finish, they go into a warm building, a coffee shop, the tube station, you know, they can find places to disperse to, and it's less of a problem. So the weather, again, I think it's the environment you're in. So it's not just a straight answer of, you know, cold is bad, you know, hot is bad. It's where are you? What shelter have you got? Like, hot weather event, you know, if you put in lots of risk mitigating factors, misting sprays, you know, gazebos over the route where with no sides on, so they're running through some shade for a little bit, reducing the time they're stood on the start line, like, you know, get them pulsed out, get them arriving. Like, there's mitigating factors you can always do. And for every event I plan, I have a cold and a hot weather plan that is specific to that event. And yes, there's general principles that go across the events, but it's, you know, very different, like planning a hot weather plan for Tough Mudder than it is to Manchester Marathon. Like Tough Mudder, we've got obstacles with water in. So, you know, one of the questions I would ask the team is, if it's really going to be hot, so we're looking at 30, 35, 40 degrees, which we're now getting in the UK, can we move the order of the obstacles around? So instead of having a water obstacle at the beginning, actually, can we stick it in the middle? Like, can we change the route? You can't do that in a marathon, But, you know, you can look at, you know, actually, do we need to shorten the route in the marathon? How do we disperse people quickly at the end? How much water have we got on site? You know, medically, we need more ice, etc. So there isn't a one stock answer of what's good and what's bad. It's where you are and you know, what resource you've got available to you.
So you've got a great thing going. You've built a great event that people love from the ground up, and you're ready to take it to the next level. But is your technology up to it? If you've been hacking your way so far using different tools for different jobs, having a so-so website and spending hours moving data back and forth from your registration platform to your email marketing provider and so on, it's time you upgraded your tech before you look into upgrading your race. With Run Signups all-in-one technology solution, you'll get all the tools you need and more all in one place to help you build a solid foundation that will help support your race's growth for years to come. Free email marketing, an awesome free custom website, a fully customizable registration experience, and awesome fundraising and participant-to-participant referral tools are just some of the things you'll be getting when you join Run Signup's industry-leading platform. With that, you'll get the resources and support you need to get you through the next stages of your growth journey and an amazing suite of race day tools to help you deliver a world-class race day experience to your participants and fans. So, to learn more about Run Signup's market-leading technology used by over 28,000 in-person, virtual, and hybrid events, and to book a free demo tailored to your needs, make sure to visit runsignup.com today. That's runsignup.com. And see what Run Signup's awesome race technology can do to take your event to the next level. Okay, now let's get back to the episode. Let's talk a little bit about planning. Let's talk a lot about planning, actually. I want to start us off with a bit of a philosophical question, I guess, on duty of care, which is an actually very kind of well-established term in itself in the UK. I'm not sure how popular it is as a term like that in the US, but it's basically, you know, like sort of the responsibility you have as a race director towards the participants who are taking part in your event. And when someone starts out their medical planning from scratch, if I did that, which I have done in the past, one of the obvious questions that comes up is, where does my responsibility sort of end? I mean, you know, you can go completely overboard, I guess, right? And try to cater for every eventuality and every little thing. From your point of view, where perhaps legally, but more importantly, morally, where does my responsibility as the provider of the duty of care sort of end or should end?
It's a good question. And it's, you know, I'm conscious that every event has a budget and costs are high at the moment. But it's not just about that. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to look at several factors. So, for example, in the UK, we've got the NHS, National Health Service, an amazing healthcare resource. But it's, you know, it's under strain. It's busy, like particularly at certain times of year, like be it hot, be it cold, you know, it's under pressure. And my philosophy is we shouldn't be putting any undue pressure on the NHS. If we are putting on a private event that is, you know, be it, you know, it's making money, it's not making money, it's still, you know, we have the duty of care not to put any undue pressure on the NHS. Now, obviously, if you've got a cardiac arrest, that patient is going to end up in hospital, whether you've got an amazing medical team on site or an awful medical team on site. Like, you know, you do everything you can and then you transfer them to secondary care, which is, you know, for us, the NHS. So that's one thing. Secondly, I say this to my medical team all the time, like, you know, every patient that is there that presents, unless, you know, it's a really bizarre event where they've not paid anything, like they are paying for you to be there. Like they've paid an entry fee. So essentially they are a private patient and we should be offering a good standard of care. And yeah, you can, I'm not saying that if you've got a 5K for five people that you've got 20 doctors stood waiting for them, you know, that's ridiculous. It has to be proportional to the distance, the risks, the number of entrants. But my, you know, my underlying principle is I feel like I've failed if the local NHS or ambulance service are put under pressure because of failings that we've put into place. It's a failure to plan. And yeah, things go wrong. And, you know, We've all seen major incidents recently in the UK, the Manchester Arena bombings. You know, there's been crushes at concerts in Brixton. You know, stuff happens that is out of our hands as a medical team. And, you know, so therefore, yes, at that point, you have to ask for help from your colleagues in the NHS. But if it's a standard, normal event, nothing is, you know, out of the ordinary, then actually, if patients are just rocking up to A&E because the medical care isn't good enough, or, you know, we're just calling the 999 all the time to come and collect our patients away because we failed to plan that we need ambulances on site that are capable of taking patients to hospital, then that's a real failure of the event. And I think reflects really badly on the medical team, but ultimately also reflects on the event. So morally, you know, I look at the distance of the event, the risk, and I put in what I think is appropriate to not impact on my colleagues working in the NHS.
It is not a very straightforward question. I agree. I mean, it's very difficult. And it's that kind of rough rule of thumb that I was looking for, meaning, you know, like, how do you even think about this thing? I think most responsible race directors would appreciate and would want to do quite a lot because it's, you know, ultimately on them. And I don't think any of them is under any delusions that the buck doesn't stop with them. But sort of where do you put an end of it? For instance, I expect, when you were mentioning earlier ambulances and stuff, I don't expect even a moderate size event should aim, for instance, to treat a heart attack, like fully right there on the course, right?
No, but they should be able to give the first line treatment that you would give to someone having a heart attack. So firstly, you need the people there that can recognize a heart attack. First aiders, you know, they're going to recognize chest pain, but can they determine whether it's someone who's got a really fast heart rate that's getting pain, or is it an actual heart attack? Is it not their heart at all? So that's kind of step one. Then you've got to have the resource to treat the heart attack. So, you know, they've recognized it's heart attack. You need someone there who can give the aspirin, who can give the GTN, which opens the blood vessels. And then you need to recognize that this is a medical emergency and you need to get them to hospital. But certainly in the UK, for example, if I did an event and I had, you know, a doctor on site and I phoned up 999 and said, oh, you know, can I have an ambulance, please? I've got someone having a heart attack. They will ask me if there is anyone medical on site. And obviously, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to be like, yeah, we've got a doctor here. We are instantly down the priority list for that ambulance to come to us. Because clearly, you know, there's a medical professional with that patient. And if someone else is having a heart attack and there's only one ambulance, and they're clearly going to send that ambulance to someone who hasn't got a doctor stood by them. So, you know, having the resource on site means that, you know, you should, you know, deal with it yourself, essentially. And I'm not saying, therefore, you shouldn't have any resource on site that you can phone the ambulance service. And, you know, one of the things, I know we've talked about this previously, is like, one of the things I often get told is, oh, but the, you know, the hospital's around the corner. Or, oh, you know, the ambulance station is literally, you know, over the road from us. Like, I literally don't care. It's irrelevant. It means literally nothing to me. The only benefit to having a local A&E department round from you is that if you had to take someone to hospital, and I mean someone appropriate to hospital, it's less of a travel time. So you are more likely to get your ambulance back quicker than if it, say, it had to go 20 miles to hospital. But having said that, also, that's not a given. There are some hospitals that can take 2-3 hours to turn an ambulance around, and others that are really quick. And again, that comes down to planning. You need to know that. If you're planning the medical event, you need to know your environment. So, for example, when I do events in Wales, I know that statistically they are slower to turn ambulances around than, say, you know, over the border into Bristol. And therefore, I need to plan that and put in maybe an extra ambulance at my event to counter that.
I'm taking from all this that you're sort of using our ambulance and their ambulance sort of interchangeably. Would you expect that some events need to have their own ambulance on standby?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Again, it comes down to the risk. So it depends on the sport. One of the things I'm really pushing for at the moment is for governing bodies in the UK, and you know, I'd love this to be broader than this, but mini battle first, let's start with the UK, to get national governing bodies to put in minimum standards of what medical you should have for their licensed events. So, for example, UK Athletics, where I'm head of medical for endurance, I am part of a team that wrote the medical guidelines that say, you know, how many first aiders, how many doctors, how many nurses you need for an event that's 1 mile, 5 miles, 10 miles for 1,000 people, 20,000 people. And we've written new guidance. We are waiting to publish them. That's more up to date and even more prescriptive than the 2013 data. And you can see if you go through those tables on the UK Athletics website, looking at it, you can see when an ambulance starts to kick in. So I'm not saying, you know, 100 runners doing a 5K needs an ambulance, but it might be if we've suddenly got 1,000 runners doing a 5K, well then actually, no, that the chance of a significant incident happening has gone up. So therefore you need an ambulance. I mean, I think it's Manchester Marathon. I think we've got 17 ambulances. And, you know, 8 doctors on the back of motorbikes, for example, plus all the cycle responders and the medical posts. Like, it's huge compared to if, you know, you had a local athletics club putting on a marathon for 50 people. It is still a marathon. So the risk is still there. But so you scale your medical down, but I'm pretty sure our data still says you need an ambulance for that number of people because, you know, and today it's still a marathon.
And out of curiosity, since, as you say, there is no regulation in place right now, in the UK at least, around this. And I saw your post yesterday on LinkedIn with a petition for people to go and sign it.
Yes, please sign it.
Absolutely, I will. And it's really important for everyone to do so, I think. Because again, like, you know, you can think, maybe some of our more libertarian listeners may think that, you know, oh, whatever, you know, like everyone's at their own risk and I'm the master of my own race and I put on whatever. But I do think that some things need to be regulated and it's not unreasonable, as you say, to have some understanding. It would help people out to have some understanding of basic minimum kind of medical requirements. It will also take that unknown off race director's shoulders. They won't have to guess. And when asked, they can say, listen, this is what I need to have and I have it kind of thing. I think it's a very comforting thing to have regulation in some areas. Because you were mentioning there the still events can sort of wing it a little bit, particularly unlicensed ones, meaning not licensed by governing body even more so. What happens out of curiosity, say in the UK, if I organize a marathon and I have completely inadequate medical cover and something goes wrong, or let's say I completely overwhelm my local NHS services or something, like, do I get a bill? Is there a law that, you know, someone comes knocking on my door? Like, what do I get sued by people? What happens?
And it's, again, it's at the moment, it's such a gray area. So for those who aren't aware of the situation in the UK, to kind of put it really simply, there is no regulation of medical companies providing medical care at events. So if you're, you know, running a nursing home or a hospital, you're regulated by something called the Quality Care Commission. We don't have that extends to event medical cover. So, you know, as simple as a description it is, you know, literally anybody, so Panos, you today could set up a website saying, you know, event medical cover is us. A race director could see that website and go, oh, brilliant. Can you do our medical cover tomorrow? And you could be like, yeah, great. You could turn up and do the event. No one has any idea that you've got no medical qualifications. You've got no insurance because a lot of people don't even check that. No idea that you're not on like the sex offenders register. Like, there is no regulation whatsoever. And unfortunately, the reality in the UK is this is happening week in, week out. I know companies that have lied to premiership netball teams and said, oh, you know, yeah, the team here today has got a paramedic. No, they don't. They're not a paramedic. And we've called them out on it and they've been asked to leave site. Like, it happens because there is no regulation. And that's what my petition about is, to get regulation. Because, you know, I'm passionate about it, but I think event directors, event companies need to also be passionate about it. Because at the moment, you've no idea if the company you're calling up to do your medical cover is, you know, safe, appropriate, trained, has the right equipment, is it all in date, is it serviced? And also, like, you might be leaning on that medical team to advise you on what medical cover you need in terms of how many doctors, how many nurses, how many first aiders. If they're not regulated, you can't actually trust anything they're saying. Like, you know, until they're caught out, like, you know, alluded to in that example, so, you know, what happens when it all gets found? Well, you know, if there's no regulation, the medical company, there's no one to hold them accountable. The race director, they're saying, well, you know, I've got no guidance. I don't know what I do. And, you know, this does happen. Now, you know, the example I gave about the Manchester Arena inquiry, where we unfortunately had a bombing at a concert a few years ago. Now, yeah, it wasn't sport, but it's the same principles. The medical company there have been found to have not put in anywhere near the right levels of medical cover. the arena has been found accountable for not, you know, ensuring that the right levels of medical cover. So they are actually being held accountable for it. But, you know, whether they're fined or whatever, I don't know what the outcome is other than reputational risk. But it's a real problem. And, you know, people say, oh, you know, it's how often does that actually happen? Well, actually, you know, real world experience of me and looking at other medical companies. And bear in mind, there are lots of really good companies. I'm not saying this is everybody, but there are companies out there that are, you know, not doing it properly. And it's scary. It's scary, even if you're just a participant. Like, you know, you want to know that the person who's there, you know, dressed all in green with paramedic blazoned across their chest is a paramedic, is still on the register of paramedics. The drugs that he's giving you aren't out of date. You know, he hasn't been sacked from the NHS because he was dodgy. Like, he or she is dodgy. Like, you want to know that the people treating at these events are, you know, medical professionals who know what they're doing. But the way I'm coming at it at the moment is, one, I'm approaching governing bodies and saying, I will write your guidance for you. I will literally produce tables of what you need for small, big, long distance, short distance. I said, I'll do it, you know, be it a swim, a triathlon, a marathon. Like, I'm very happy to do it because that takes some of the guesswork out of it for the events team. But also, you know, the UK government need to get on and regulate this. But that's not going to be quick. And I'd imagine that the UK isn't unique to this situation. I'd imagine there are other examples around the world.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Can I quickly clarify something? Because you kept mentioning the whole paramedic term, and I appreciate that even here there might be some subtleties across parts of the world, like US and here and other parts of the world. Is a paramedic a first aider, essentially? Is he like more than a first aider? Is he a doctor? Where does he lie, basically, in that spectrum?
So you're right. There are different terminologies, and some are what we call, certainly in the UK, we call them a protected title, and others are not. So, for example, a doctor in the UK is someone who has been through medical training, doesn't have to be within the UK, but has basically gone through medical school and has certificates say, you know, I am actually trained as a doctor. Now, you know, if you're saying your event needs a doctor, it's not as simple as saying, oh, good, I've got a doctor, because, you know, is that doctor 1 year qualified? Are they 30 year qualified? Are they actually registered to work in your country? That's something that we see quite a lot of. You know, also, what are they trained in? So it's great you've got someone who's 20 years qualified, but actually, if they're a heart surgeon, are they going to be any good to you with someone who's collapsing at the finish line with hypothermia? You know, it's, you know, doctor, broad spectrum term, but technically on paper, it's a protected title. A paramedic, again, is a protected title. So it's someone who has been through paramedic training. And, you know, doctors and paramedics at events, very interchangeable how we work, because we've got a lot of the same skill sets, but we do diverge a little bit in the finer details. But again, it depends on their training. You know, how many years qualified is that paramedic? What experience are they getting? Because if they just work for an event medical company, they could be sat by the edge of a football pitch for half a year and not treat anyone. And so then you get from someone really sick at a marathon, like, actually, have they got that experience to deal with it? Because if they're not doing, you know, daily paramedic work within a normal environment, then you de-skill. The term that's not protected is first aider. And this is one of those super grey areas, again, within the UK, but I can imagine it's not unique to us, where it's not a protected title. So you could do a half-day first aid at work training course to be able to treat your colleague if they get a cut. And someone can then say, oh, I'm a first aider, I'll do your event cover. Now, that's not good enough. I also get a lot of people, event companies saying to me, oh, but we've got first aiders within the events team, so can they just do the medical cover on the day? No, they can't, because for several reasons. One, you know, what training have they actually got? Who's providing their equipment? It's very different to have a little first aid kit in your event office for someone who's cut themselves compared to actually treating really quite unwell people on the course. Also, if they're part of your event team, they've probably got another job to do on the day. You know, if you're there as a medic, you are there as a medic. You're not dual rolling. You need to be, you know, in your medical post or on your response bike or whatever it is, doing purely that role. And, you know, I've talked about equipment, but also who's insuring them? Like, you know, you need proper medical insurance to treat people. And it might seem an easy, cheap option at the time. Go, oh, we'll just use the event team. They'll be able to cope with it. Try using that argument when you're in front of a coroner, when something's happened. Like, you'll get ripped to shreds. Like, one, our UK Athletics guidance that was written in 2013 for really small events did allow it to happen. The new guidance that's coming out saying it's gone. We've taken that out. We've said if you're putting an event on and we are stipulating it has to have a first aider on site, we are stipulating that it's someone that is from a medical company that you trust, if you can find one, and they've got all the proper insurance, the proper equipment, and ideally going forward, hopefully that they're regulated, and, you know, leave your event team to do event work on the day.
Yeah, I think it's a very important point. When I did my mountain race, I just felt like I wanted to do like an outdoor first aid kind of course, simply because I would be around, right?
Yep.
But I think it's an interesting point. Of all the things that you mentioned, equipment and all the other stuff, I think the more important thing to understand for people thinking of sort of double rolling that is that you have other stuff to do. You should. I mean, if you're the race director or the assistant race director, or you're doing like other things, you shouldn't have first aid. I mean, it's okay to have that skill, as I said, but you shouldn't consider yourself like as a proper first aid headcount or something, because you're not on the day.
Correct. And certainly I would encourage event organizers to put their team through first aid training. Like, I think that's really, really vital, because often they are the people that find the patient. Like, you know, you can have lots of medics, but there's still going to be gaps where we can't have eyes on every single runner wherever they are on the marathon course. So it might be, you know, your sector leader that finds someone in the marathon who's collapsed at the side of the road, and they're going to stay with them until we can get to them. So it's one of, you know, it's one of the things I think is helpful that they are, you know, trained in basic life support, know how to cool somebody. So we've started at the marathon giving the sector leaders some basic cooling things, just like, you know, a misting spray. So just got some bottled water in it. It could be tap water in it. And they're just constantly spraying it over the participant to cool them down. And it seems really basic, but actually that's starting getting them better already. And you know, it buys us as the medical team a little bit of time. Like, if we're busy or we've got to come from an awkward location because the participant has happened to collapse in the opposite direction to which the ambulance is pointing, and we've got to turn it around and get it, not go against the flow of runners to get to them, it buys us a little bit of time. So I think absolutely members of the event team should be trained in first aid. I think that's vital. And to be honest, I think everyone should be trained in first aid, not just at events, but they shouldn't be the medical team. They should not count in the numbers. It's not appropriate in this day and age. It might have been 20, 30 years ago, but it's certainly not now.
You mentioned earlier how tricky it is to go out and hire a third-party medical company. Are there any kind of like practical tips on making sure you somehow diligence the situation a little bit, so at least you exclude the obvious red flags with a company, or you ask some basic questions, I guess, to make sure that, you know, you're hiring someone who's skilled in that role?
Yeah, I mean, until there's regulation, it's tough. I mean, within the UK, there is a vague, tenuous link of registration with the CQC. So if you're a medical company that supplies ambulances, the CQC will come in and inspect you. So, you know, if I am, like my company, for example, we don't do ambulances. We're doctors, nurses, first aiders, physios, and we will always work with another company to do our ambulance provision. That's just a decision I made years back when I started the company. So I can't be regulated at the moment. But if I'm picking an ambulance company to work with me, absolutely they need to be CQC registered. Now, that's obviously only, that's an England thing. If, you know, broader than that, though, I think, I mean, you wouldn't hire someone in any other job occupation without references. So if you're thinking of using a company, ask them who they've worked for, go and ask and get a reference from them and see, you know, how did they interact with you? How responsive were they to emails? What were they like on the day? Did they turn up on time? Were they appropriately dressed? Did you get any feedback from participants, either positive or negative, about them? Also ask to see documents. So, you know, for example, if I'm planning an event, I write a medical operations plan before the event that's really detailed. It's got everything from maps, it's got local hospitals, it's got, you know, call signs for everybody. And that's my Bible, basically. If I, you know, on the morning of the event was suddenly really ill, so I've got diarrhea and vomiting, can't physically be at the event, a member of my team should be able to pick up that ops plan and go, right, I know exactly what I'm doing. And that should, every medical company should be producing those for an event, be it tiny or a massive event, you need a plan. And so if you're going out trying to find a medical team, you know, ask to see an example of a plan, and they can reconduct it. They can take out the names of the companies or anything that's really sensitive to that event. But just as an example, say, look, this is the work we deliver. But I think ask around. I think that's the main thing. You know, certainly in our industry in England, there are companies that if people said to me, oh, have you heard of so-and-so, who I'd be like, yeah, they're great. You know, really good experience of working with them. I've only heard positive things. And there'll be others who are like, absolutely not, keep away from them. You know, ask. Don't just go for the cheapest quote. Cheap is not, and you know, it's with anything, you know, it's not always the right thing. And it's often cheap for a reason. And is it because they cut corners? Are they telling you they're putting paramedics in and they're not? Like, you know, just raise the question. And I'm not saying you should go for the most expensive either, because I've seen some ridiculous tenders when I've managed tenders before for events. You know, look at the detail, look what information they're giving you, you know, check out their website. For me, I've got a bit of a red flag. If the website's full of pictures of ambulances, I'm normally a little bit worried about them. Generally, the more ambulances or people stood posing in front of all their vehicles makes me a little bit nervous. That's just my own personal experience, my own feelings of it. And there will be companies that have lots of ambulances on their website, and they're absolutely fine, but it always makes me feel a little bit like, oh God, here we go again. So shop around and don't leave it till last minute. Like, if you're planning an event, please get your medical cover in place at least 6 months in advance, because, you know, that gives the medical team ample time to staff it. You know, write plans, have meetings with them, do site visits, like all the things that you should be doing with them. The later you leave it, the more you are likely to be scraping the barrel.
So obviously you see both sides of this because you also run a company like that yourself. When a race director goes to a company like yours, you know, and says, I need medical cover for my event, it's a 10K, it's blah, blah, blah. From all the different little Lego pieces that you have, you know, doctors, first aiders, all of that stuff, how do you come up with like the level of provision? And I know this is a kind of like typical how long is a piece of string kind of question, but I'm thinking mostly of, I guess, how do the different roles in that plan work? The doctor and the first aider and the paramedic and the ambulance, basically, like, how, in terms of their strengths and weaknesses, like, how do you use all of that resource you have to come together with a plan?
I mean, you're right. There isn't an answer. I suppose there's several things to do. One, I pull on my experience. I've done so many different types of events now. I mean, hundreds of events that I've got a gut feeling now of, you know, what feels right, what doesn't, as a baseline. And I said, ask for data of previous events as well and look at the injury profile. So for example, we've been asked to do an event potentially in 2 months time, which is relatively last minute, that it's a relatively large event. And, you know, I've been given data of predicted numbers per medical post, but they haven't broken it down to how serious those patients are. And that's vital. So I've gone back and said, look, I need a bit more of a breakdown. Again, if there's a national governing body that's produced regulations, I absolutely look at that. And to be honest, if it's a running event, even if they're not licensed by UK Athletics, I still use the standards written by UK Athletics, partly because I wrote them. But because, you know, if it's good enough for a licensed event, it should be good enough for an unlicensed event. In terms of how it's then done on the day, if say you haven't got any information, you've got nothing, I think first gives you a risk assessment. So, you know, how hot is, how long it is, how many runners, how many people do you think on balance are likely to be sick? As a company, I appreciate we are different. So we are very healthcare professional led. So if you went back 10 years ago, the majority of event cover would be very first aider heavy, with the odd doctor, the odd nurse kind of splattered around. We are the polar opposite of that, because the events that we do are high risk, and they're either high risk because of the sheer numbers they're doing or the distance they're doing or the actual event itself. So we are very doctor nurse heavy. So, you know, we might have an event with 20 doctors and 10 nurses and only 10 first aiders. Like, it's completely the other way around. But that is based on, I suppose, our knowledge of sport and events, both from experience, but also, you know, like, my training is sports and exercise medicine. Like, there aren't many of us out there who, that is literally what we learn for 4 years in our training as post becoming doctors. So I just use that kind of experience, and it's hard though. And that's why I am pushing governing bodies to kind of let me write, you know, baselines so that, you know, you can use them and go, you know, okay, I'm doing an open water swim. How many, you know, what should I have for my 10K open water swim in February? Fine. If there's a table they can look at and says, you know, in ideal weather conditions, this is what you should put in. Then you've got that as your template. And then you go, well, actually, you know, it's going to be really cold that day. I need to up it from that level. But you know, gut feeling, and that's where you as race directors have to trust. You need to trust your medical teams. And that's why picking your medical team is absolutely integral.
And once that medical team is picked and hired, and obviously I provide them all the information they may need to come up with a plan, is there anything else remaining for me, the race director, to do? Like, I don't need to be having my own kind of like medical equipment provisions or anything like that, or like first aid kits even, or even simple stuff, do I?
No, I mean, like I said, if you've got event team who are first aid trained, then it's worth giving them a little bit of basic first aid equipment. But bear in mind that they shouldn't just see and treat a patient on their own. I know they should, you know, start treatment and then get backup from the medical team coming in. If it's an event with a first aid room that's already there, so for example, I work for England Netball. I was in the Nottingham Motorpoint Arena recently for an England Netball match. You know, there's a first aid room there. So I want to know pre-event, you know, what's in that room? Can I use it? Is there a clinical waste bin? Is there a sink? You know, so if you've got existing infrastructure, then pass that information over to your medical team. But in theory, you are bringing in a medical team who should be self-sufficient. Granted, I will ask for help with generators, marquees, tables, chairs, because, you know, funnily enough, I don't have a 30 by 25 meter marquee in my house that I can use for Manchester Marathon. Of course, I'm going to ask the race director if they can assist with that. So there's always a discussion of, you know, okay, can you provide the radios? We'll provide this. And that needs to be clear in the tendering process. So if I'm doing a quote for an event, I'll write my resourcing. I'll put the bottom key items that I want, you know, the ambulance provider to bring, like the ambulances, and any gases, or if I'm stipulating they need like really specific stuff, I'll stipulate it. And then at the bottom, I'll put a list of items that I would like the race to provide. And it might be like radios, ice, this amount of water, this number of tables, this number of chairs. And you have to be upfront from that from the beginning. And it means that, you know, I'll tender for events and I'll do a whole load of work that might take me 2 days to put a proper document together, and we don't get the event. But you've got to be upfront from the beginning and say, this is what it's going to take for us to deliver this event for you.
And I guess the lesson there for the race director is that that's also the level of detail you should expect in a tender from a company. I think people should be aware that. And it could be well-meaning, but you don't want sort of like gray areas and stuff left out of the tender. Like, you want everything specified, who brings what, what's expected of everyone. So it's all sort of like, just for good order's sake, just all taken down sort of in writing. So there's no kind of ambiguity around stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all very, because you might go, oh, this company looks cheaper, we'll use them. You know, everything else looks good. Everything they've told us about them, their references are fantastic. And then, you know, 3 weeks before the event, they're like, oh, you know, we need this marquee doing. You're like, you never said that. And now that's suddenly a lot more cost, and you've got to sort it and arrange it. And it needs to be upfront. And equally, I would implore people that when we actually write you a medical operations plan, please, can you actually read it? Because there will be detail in there that you might not have clocked. And I've had this before. I've had it at an event where it was all in the tender and I was like, okay, we need this size medical post to be at the finish. It was a cycle event. I want it right by the finish line. I want it in here. I've got 3 weeks out, and they phoned me and went, oh, we didn't know we were providing all the medical structures. And like, it's literally been in everything from the very beginning. Like, you've had version 1 to 6 of the medical plan. It's been in there since version 1. It shouldn't be a surprise. Like, I've told you, you know, I can only tell you a certain number of times. It's up to you to read it. But we don't write the medical plans purely for the medical team only. it's for the event as well. And so the event needs to read it. And I share those medical plans with the statutory services around me. So if I'm doing an event in London, I send my medical plans to London Ambulance Service so that they are aware of the event. I send it to the hospitals that are potentially a receiving hospital because they might want to put more staff on that day, knowing that actually they could be a lot busier. So the plan, yeah, it's the manual for the medical team, but it's for everybody else as well. And so, you know, the moment I write a plan, I share it with everybody and go, right, can I have your input? Is there anything that changes? It's similar to last year, but this has changed. Can you make sure that this is all right?
And the emergency services that you're sharing those plans with, are they generally welcoming of them? Or like, you know, would they have a person who's like, thank you? Is there a process? Like, is there like a structure there on the other end of the emergency services for someone to take in those plans and take the appropriate action?
Certainly in the ambulance service, yes. So I think this is a general term across the UK, but I think they're called resilience planners or emergency planners within the ambulance service. And like for London, there's several of them. London's broken up into regions. And I know that, you know, I send it to Matt if it's a central event, for example. And he comes back to me and every time he's like, thank you. Like, you know, really appreciate it. And we've got such a long working relationship now. He never questions me on anything. He's like, yeah, it's fine. It's you. I'm quite happy. I don't know what conversations he has with other medics, but, you know, it's always very positive. The hospitals is always a harder one to do because there isn't necessarily one person who takes the lead within the hospital for me to send the email to. So what I normally do, if I don't already know, is I'll phone up the A&E department and ask for the secretary of the lead consultant. Because at the end of the day, it's A&E that's going to take the battering. They're the ones that need to know about it. And I get their email address and I send them the email. And I will often be like, if there's anyone else you want me to share this with, please let me know. Yeah, every year I have to go through the process of checking again because they often will be like, you know, or they've left or they're no longer the lead, it's somebody else. Or they've changed the domain name on the email addresses and they're all bouncing and you just have to, and it's time consuming. But again, that's the role of the medical team, like should be doing that. That is something that I spec as part of my time because I know it takes time, particularly if you've got six or seven receiving hospitals around you, you've got to phone every single one of them. And it's, anyone who's phoned a hospital switchboard, you'll realize that it's not a quick process to get through to the person that you actually want to speak to, as you keep repeatedly put through to the canteen when you actually want the A&E department. But it needs to, again, it's something that I view as vital.
Let's talk participants for a sec. Two aspects of that. The first thing I wanted to ask, collecting participant information. Again, there may be some slight differences, particularly because of privacy laws between UK and US and other parts of the world. But as an event director for these kinds of races we're putting on, what kind of information should you look to collect from participants? Speaking of, you know, like you don't want to be going again overboard, like useful, necessary stuff. What kind of information would you want to collect? How would you collect it? You know, how would you ask it? At what point? How would you keep a record of it? And how do you actually retrieve it when you need it and use it?
So there's several ways this process currently happens at the events I work at. I think in terms of how the data is collected, it's all collected when they sign up to the event. So they go online, register for the event. It asks them to put in some basic medical details. And what I'm interested in is I want to know if they got any significant medical illnesses. So I don't want to know that they had a cold last week. But I do want to know that they had open heart surgery 2 years ago, or they've just had cancer treatment, or they're asthmatic. It should be things that stick out in the person's mind. They shouldn't have to sit there going, oh, do I have this condition? Should I write that down? It should be, you know, it's big stuff. Also, the big one for me is allergies. So, you know, are they allergic to anything? Because, you know, people are allergic to medication. And the last thing we want to do is to make someone worse. And we use this data. So, you know, prime example, London Winter Run this year, we had someone who was unconscious during the event. You know, first thing I did was get them to confirm, the medics on the scene confirm the runner number. And then I looked up that runner number's details and was able to confirm that they declared that they had no medical information. So they had said there was nothing wrong with them. That doesn't mean they don't. It just means they didn't bother to fill in the bit to say, no, they didn't have anything. It was just blank. Whereas other times, you know, you get detailed information. The other thing I get them to also check on the scene is a lot of events have the ability to write medical information on the back of the bib. So you pulled off the runner number and on the back of it, it had her name. So that was the other thing that was helpful, is it confirmed that the runner number and her name were the same person, i.e. she hasn't registered and then got some her friend to run for her because she couldn't run. Because, you know, that's really important that we know it's the right person. And in terms of actually how I see that data, basically there's two ways it's done to me. The event team either email it to me with a password protection on it on the day, but they all normally send it to me about a week out as well, just to have a highlight read through it. Or I'm given an encrypted memory stick on the day in event control so that I've got access to it. The third option is I don't own the data. Someone else has it on their laptop from the event team, and I will go up to them in event control, go, can you look at runner number 1234 and tell me who they are and whether they've got anything wrong with them. And then obviously it's all linked to the next of kin details as well. So if we've got cardiac arrest, something like that, my role during that is to phone the next of kin as well. So we use that data. And that's why it's so important that it's the right person, because I don't want to phone the wrong person. And I will often ask the medical team, is there anyone around that person who's collapsed who appears to know them, to see if they can confirm their name, just to make sure that it is absolutely the right person that is registered on our system as being the runner.
A couple of races that I used to do, particularly a few years back in Europe, they used to also insist, particularly marathons, on receiving a medical certificate, which most of the times meant you had to have like a doctor or something, you know, do some kind of examination on you and sign it. Some of them were quite demanding on, you know, being seen by a heart specialist or something, or a cardiologist of some sort. And I've always wondered, particularly since I've seen how I was examined in some of those cases, very kind of like, yeah, you look great. Yeah, you're, you know, whatever, a bit of a rubber stamp. Do you think this as an extra layer of protection, I guess, does it help at all having, you know, putting participants through that kind of process?
Gut feeling, no. Yes, it probably does pick up the odd person, maybe one in 500,000 people who didn't know that they had a funny heart rhythm, and it picks it up. And I know of an athlete who recently had a medical to go to the States to swim for university or college, I think they call it other. And he was found to have a dangerous heart rhythm that actually stopped him swimming. So, you know, medicals can pick up things. Having said that, first question is who's doing the medical? So it could be a GP or a family medicine doctor, I think it's called in the States, or it could be a sports medicine consultant. So, you know, you're going to get differing areas of knowledge of who's doing it. I know certainly in the UK, there's a lot of GPs that will not sign these forms because they're like, I'm not trained in this. This isn't my remit. Why am I signing this off? Like, I don't want the risk of it. So I don't think it adds a great deal. What I think is more important is that we implore participants, if they've got a concern and are like, oh, you know, should I be running or can I do this, to contact the event, who can then contact the medical team and ask them. And I get, you know, there's certain events I will get a couple of emails from, be like, you know, they've just had, you know, they had a heart attack 2 months ago. Are they okay to do this 10K? They're only going to walk it or whatever. And often I will say, look, actually, you know, you are a little bit high risk. Could we, like, we can't stop you racing, but it would make everyone feel a lot happier if you could get a letter from your surgeon or your cardiologist to say, I'm okay with this. We can't stop them in the UK saying you can't compete. That's not something we're allowed to do over here. But certainly, you know, I would rather be prepared, the medical team be prepared and aware of that runner than, you know, them try and keep it kind of brushed under the carpet and not let us know. You know, again, another example of it was at athletics, British Athletics Championships indoors a few weeks ago. And one of the athletes came up to me before the event and went, I've got a bit of a problem at the moment. I keep collapsing in races. It's being investigated, but I want you to be aware of this. And she did collapse. And, you know, we were absolutely ready. I mean, we're already ready there anyway. We've got all the kit ready, but we, you know, literally gloves on, stood by the edge of the track ready.
So is that an elite?
Yeah, it's elite.
That sounds like almost Monty Python-esque. I keep collapsing at races. I mean, okay, don't race anymore.
I mean, she'd been told that, you know, because it was all undetermined, they'd said she could still race. So, you know, I'm not going to stop her, but we very much appreciated the heads up. It meant we were prepared for it. We weren't shocked and kind of like, oh my God, someone's unconscious on the track. We're very much like, you know, that's, you know, we were expecting this. It's okay. you know, none of us looked stressed by it because it was something we were all very aware could happen. So, you know, we would rather people gave us that heads up and said, I've got this problem. Here is a letter from my surgeon or my doctor saying, actually, it's fine. But I think blanket routinely screening, unless there is an absolute proper process for it, a very specific form, and it's seen, you know, by a sports medicine consultant who's overseeing it, you know, and that's, it's just not viable. I mean, there's just not that many of us around. So, you know, it would make us very busy. It'd be financially great, but I think it's not a long-term solution for events to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's. I always suspected that it was a little bit of a box ticking exercise, to be honest. Just and maybe in some countries, like I raced I did the Rome Marathon a while back. Coming from Greece myself, I know how regulation works in South Europe. I think it's a lot of like arse covering, to be honest. Like, you know, want to like, you know, like you know, like what are you after me for? You know, I checked it, and what, you know, it's like people just basically wanting to shift the responsibility to someone else. I want to wrap us up with a little bit of a look on, which is something, again, maybe the your third-party medical provider is doing, at recording the incidents that happen during a race. Is there like a standard to that, or is every company would have their own way of recording, or even the same level of detail they might go in? So you have a log after the race of everything that happened and maybe kind of learn from it and improve?
Yeah, I think there should be a standard. In short answer, there isn't. I, for example, take writing the medical report quite seriously. For me, it is a document that one is, it accounts for what's happened, but it's also a learning for next year. So I will summarize, you know, how many medics were there, where they were. Like, even though it's in the medical plan, it might be different on the day. Like, you know, since you wrote the plan, you might have had some, 3 days pre-event, you might have known that the weather's going to be really, really hot, and suddenly you've added a load of extra medics. So, you know, that needs detailing. Equally, people can be ill on the day. So you need to know whether you were short of people and how you manage that. So I will document, you know, every detail, what went well, what didn't go well. You know, do we need more tables next year, more chairs, better lighting? Was a speaker too close to the medical tent for the sound system for the finish line so we couldn't hear? Like, you know, that means that next year when they're planning the event, they can look at how they're doing the sound rigging. I kind of break it down into, you know, categories like course posts, finish post, stewarding. Did we have any problems with stewards? You know, sometimes it can be a brilliant experience, other times it can be not. And that's important to feedback. And obviously casualty data. So, you know, how many people were treated in each medical post? Were they all minor? Was there anything serious? Where did they go to hospital if they did? Do we have any follow-up information? Often we don't, you know, I can't ring the hospital and say, oh, we took Jane Smith to the hospital on Sunday. Can you let me know what happened? I'm not allowed to know that information. So we have a system, if we give a business card to any person going to hospital, if they're really sick, we'll give it to the friend or the relative traveling with them. And it basically just says, we would love to know how you get on. Please get in touch. And it's got my details. And about 20% of the time, we get a lovely email back saying, thank you so much. You know, really great experience. Just to let you know, this is what they found. And often I get a, could you also send me a medal and a t-shirt because I didn't cross the finish line or didn't get it? And well, yeah, we'll always arrange that. We'll sort that out. But I think a medical report is as important as the medical plan. You know, every time I do either a new event or a repeat event, I go back to similar event medical reports and trawl through them. And what did I learn? You know, what can I put in? And it just makes it so much easier when you're writing the medical plan for the next year because you're like, okay, this is what went well, but this is the stuff we need to focus on. Like, you know, we didn't have enough ice, or actually the towels that turned up were actually blankets and didn't absorb much water for cooling. Like next year we need proper towels, etc. And if you're doing lots of events, you don't remember this detail. It has to be written down. How big or small your event is, you need a medical report. And if it's a small event and you treat one person, then, you know, half the page will be literally just detailing the event, where you were, what the weather was. That's the other thing I document in the medical report. Like, I take a wet bulb globe with me. I measure the weather at several times throughout the day. I'll document that because that affects your data interpretation. And so, yeah, every event should have a medical report. And that, again, you know, you went back to asking about how you get a medical provider. Ask them what kind of detail you get in your medical report and see what comes back.
Yeah. And I completely agree with the sentiment that I don't think you should even leave that for later or much later, to be honest. I mean, obviously, you know, you want to treat someone and then probably make some notes, but you jump even on the most basic business call. And if you don't take notes, the minute you hung up, you've half lost half of the stuff you were discussing. Plus time tends to change your perception of what has happened. I mean, this is very well documented in like human psychology. You can't be trusted to even remember or take notes of what may have happened like a day or 2 days ago. And that thing with a business card, actually, it's an awesome little touch that I think lots of people would appreciate, both for the practicality and for the gesture of it, right? I mean, that shows we care. Exactly.
Yeah. And you're right. Like, if I don't write a medical report quickly, you forget the information. So I write it as I'm going on, even on the setup days. Like, the event might be on a Saturday, Sunday, and I'm setting up the marquee on a Thursday, Friday. You know, I will write notes as I'm going along. Right. You know, tables and chairs arrive late. This delayed this. Therefore, next time we need them earlier, etc. During the event, still writing notes. Like, every time something happens, I'll just jot something down on my phone to say, you know, okay, this patient went to this hospital. And yeah, we've got a log that's tracking that in event control anyway, but it's just easier just for me to write it down and then I've got it. And I'll submit every medical report, unless it's like from a world championships and it's like 20 pages long. Like, most events, the vast majority, I've submitted within 2 days because I want it done, because I'm already thinking about the next event anyway. I've already moved on. Like, I need to, you know, medical report writing for me is the close of the event. Unless we've got like coroners or something else that we need to do, that's the end, move on. That's the other thing. Coroners will also ask for medical reports as well.
Knock on wood that there needs to be a coroner involved in any of this.
It's happened once.
It's happened actually to a couple of people I know, and it's particularly for it actually happened to Matt Trevett, might be listening into this, in his inaugural event. And it can be a very, very shocking
thing. It's traumatic.
To go through. It's a numbers thing. I mean, it might happen to you, you know, if it's your first event or your 100th, I guess, not something you want on race day. If people want to maybe follow up with you on some of these things we've been discussing, or have some questions, because I know that, you know, like, we've answered lots of questions, but particularly around the point of hiring medical staff and things, I think we may have raised some concerns and questions as well. If people wanna maybe reach out, have a chat, how can they reach you?
Best probably by email, because as you alluded to at the very beginning, I have many jobs and I'm all over the place and often with patients, so can't answer my phone. Drop me an email. I'm very happy for my email address to be shared, or through the Sports Medics website. If you go to a contact us form on there, it comes through to me. Very happy to answer questions, because I mean, I think as you can probably tell, because I don't shut up about it, events are my passion. It's what I love of all the forms of medicine I've ever worked in. I just want to make it better and to make it right. And if that's my legacy in this world, then absolutely I will do it. And, you know, go back to my petition. Please, everyone, sign the petition. Quite happy to share that link out. Events need to do better. Simply, and it is our responsibility as medics and race directors to do that, and it's everyone's responsibility, and we just need to get it right, do it right.
We are going to put the link, actually we should include the link to that petition in the show notes, and I'm going to add your email there. You're also contactable, obviously, you're on LinkedIn.
Yeah,
but that took us a few months to connect through that, so I don't
it's not the quickest.
Yeah, not the quickest with you, definitely not the quickest.
Emails, I'm really quick. LinkedIn, definitely not.
Absolutely, as is everyone, I guess. So, yeah, listen, I think for such a relatively stiff topic, I think it was very thoroughly enjoyable, coroners aside and all that. I want to thank you very much for your time, Natasha. I really appreciate it. I think we covered lots of ground with some very interesting tips, even if some of the discussion was a little bit more UK-based. I think there's lots of stuff there that applies. So thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
No, loved it. It's been great speaking to you. And I say, anything I can do to help, just shout.
Absolutely. And thank you very much to everyone listening in. And we'll see you all on our next podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's episode on race medical planning with Sports Medics Natasha Beach. You can find more resources on anything and everything related to race directing on our website, racedirectorshq.com. You can also share your thoughts about medical risk and contingency planning or anything else in our Facebook group, Race Directors Hub. Many thanks again to our awesome podcast sponsor, RunSignUp, for sponsoring today's episode. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe on your favorite player. And do check out our podcast back catalog for more great content like this. Until our next episode, take care and keep putting on amazing races.